You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. The transitioning of kids is ever more common these days, despite growing concerns about physical, mental, and social impacts of encouraging youth to identify as the opposite sex. A new documentary film, Transmission, explores the background, messaging, and consequences of medically and surgically transitioning kids through conversations with doctors, experts, parents, educators, and detransitioners. In this episode, I speak with Jennifer Lahl, founder and president of the Center for Bioethics and Culture Network, and a pediatric nurse whose writing has been published in Cambridge University Press, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Dallas Morning News, and the American Journal of Bioethics. Jennifer serves on the North American Editorial Board for Ethics and Medicine, and she directed Exploitation and Big Fertility, both of which explore the infertility industry. Her most recent documentary film, Transmission, is now available to watch on YouTube. Thanks so much for joining me today. I really, really appreciate your work. I really appreciate that you made this film, Transmission, so I'm looking forward to talking to you about what you learned and about that process.
Yeah, thanks for being in the film.
Happy to, of course. So what is it that prompted you to make the film?
You know, in a prior life, I was a pediatric critical care nurse for many, many years. So I've always been interested in kids and medicine and science and technology. So that was kind of in the back burner. But then I started this new work where I was heavily invested in the space of assisted reproduction and especially egg donation and surrogacy and the use of women's bodies to help people have babies, help in quotes, and the medical risks and the harms and all the ethical problems with those kinds of commercial arrangements with using a woman's body to help other people, mostly rich people. And then, you know, slowly, you know, I didn't want to creep into this space, but, you know, trans men and trans women started having babies and using assisted reproductive technologies. And then several months ago, a study came out where they surveyed trans women who said that they would like to be considered in the pool of uterine transplants, because, you know, we're already doing uterine transplants in women that for various reasons had to lose their uterus and now have a transplant so they can have babies. And so I've been writing a lot about uterine transplants and artificial wombs anyway, as far as in adults, women. And then by golly, the trans people, you know, got into that. And then I became very aware and concerned about all the fertility preservation that's being offered to young children, trans children. So before a little girl goes on puberty blockers, you know, or starts moving into the full medical and surgical transition, you know, she's offered to bank and freeze her eggs so that when she becomes a identifying trans man, she can go back to the IVF lab and use her own eggs as a trans man to have, you know, her own biological children. And then I just finally said, well, damn it, I think I have to make a movie on this space because, you know, I have a little bit of history in just pediatric nursing. And then this interest in all this high tech stuff. And that's where I landed. I was talking on the phone one day with another person who was very interested and worried about this space. And I just said, you know, there needs to be a movie. And out of that conversation, it was like, yeah, we're going to make that movie. So during the pandemic, we were, you know, pre-production, post-production, production. It's the first film I made during a global pandemic. So that had all kinds of interesting hurdles. But yeah, I guess that's sort of the road that I took to get me to write and produce Transmission.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit more about these new reproductive technologies? Are uterine transplants something that is actually happening? Are they actually trying to do this currently for real?
Yeah, they've actually already done uterine transplants, and there's been a few successes in that women have actually carried a pregnancy to term in with a transplanted uterus. The
I
the
mean,
thing that
sorry, I actually meant in men. Sorry, I should have been more
in
specific.
men.
I'm thinking of the trans women,
No, but you're
the question of putting uteruses in men so that they can somehow give birth.
not there yet, but there is research, of course, in mice. And there is a study that came out just a few weeks ago where they've actually put mice uteruses into uteri into male mice to see what happens. And could these mice, be able to carry a little pregnancy to term? That's kind of how the research usually starts, right? We start it in animals and we see if we can do it. Then we move to larger animals like, sheep and goats and dogs. So the research is, absolutely taking place to see if we can do it. Now, whether we can do it and successfully do it, I don't know. But there's certainly people that are invested in doing this kind of research.
It seems a bit creepy, doesn't
Oh, totally. Totally. And when you think about in the case of a woman, I mean, we're born with uteruses. We're supposed to have them in our body. But when you look at the woman who has a transplanted uterus, she's like an organ donor. She has to take anti-rejection drugs for the duration of her pregnancy, so that she doesn't reject this donated uterus. We don't know what are the long-term, short or long-term effects on her health or the health of the developing fetus that she's carrying on taking these, or rejection, anti-rejection medication. Most commonly, what happens is after the woman delivers, is they surgically remove the uterus, so that she doesn't have to stay on lifelong anti-rejection medications. So the uterus is removed, unlike the organ donor who lives taking these medicines for forever. And of course, she has to deliver by C-section because it's not her own uterus, and because it's still experimental, they're not allowing her to labor and delivery. So she's got all these risks. It's weird to me because we try to have all of these. I follow like the Free Birth Society movement and the women that are really rejecting medical intervention and saying, our bodies know how to do this. Just leave us alone. And then over here, we're just like layering on any kind of technology we can possibly lay on to help a woman have a baby. I love like Mary Lou Singleton's, phrase about you. It's hard to say no to technology once you say yes to it. Because the doctor just wants to layer on more and more and more tests and interventions.
Yeah, and it just seems like it's all part of this trend to a trend to kind of, not only dehumanize human beings, but pretend as though human beings aren't a part of nature, that our bodies are sort of like just a collection of robot parts, and you can take one part and put it over here, and it's not like a holistic thing at all. It's not all interconnected, and that's just like opposite of what's true. I mean, everything is super interconnected in terms of our bodies and nature, and how evolution has impacted our bodies and how they function and things like that.
Yeah, and you've seen a lot of more recently connections between the transgender movement and transhumanism, and that is sort of denying the naturalistic the body, and just saying we can cut this off and we can add this widget and we can put chips in our brains and it's the turning us into sort of half machine cyborgs But then, it's really weird because I live in, the backyard of the Silicon Valley, and everybody's into no hormones in their food or their water and no pesticides. And, it's really schizophrenic. On one hand, we want to be really, really close to nature. And then on the other hand, we just want to sort of, destroy it.
Yeah, what does transhumanism actually mean? I feel like we hear about that a lot, but I'm not sure the general population really knows what that term means.
There's very various levels of transhumanistic thinking, whether it's a philosophy or an idea, but it's this notion that we can overcome our humanity and we're just passing through. So we're transitioning from human, over into some combination of human machine, or the real radical transhumanists who say that we can live forever and just become, a virtual entities, is sort of more on the extreme side. But it is this notion that, whatever we need to do to overcome aging, sickness, death, through technology should be pursued to take us to the next level of being, whatever that being is. I remember being at a dinner once with a couple of transhumanists, and I remember this one really radical, extreme one. It was talking about neural networks and how our brains would all just be interconnected, and we could walk into a conference and have a chip in our brain that would tell us that so and so in our database is over there. It was just kind of bizarre. And I said, I don't really know if I want to live in a world like that. And she said, well, you can be like the Amish and you can just go live in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. We're not going to make you do this. You can choose not to. But again, we know that once technology is there, that the ability to choose not to, I mean, I panic if I can't find my phone, once we have sort of gotten ourselves addicted to it, it's really hard to just say no. And then you'll just be the little marginalized people over there that still do things the old-fashioned way. I still have to look up my contacts and see what, your phone number is so I can call you versus somebody else who has their all their contacts of a chip in their brain.
Yeah, well, and you really can't function without these technologies anymore. I mean, everything, almost everything happens on apps, including, like checking in at the airport and, now these vaccine passports and of course, like you say, things like just our all of our contacts. There's a lot of processes, calling an Uber, like, there's all these things that you just can't do anymore. Unless you participate in these kinds of technologies, unless you have an iPhone. This is getting way off topic, but I'll come back to the real topic in just a moment. But like I came back from Canada, from Mexico, right? And they make you quarantine for 2 weeks, and they make you, they make you show your test results, and they make you like check in every day to say that you don't have a fever or COVID fit symptoms, and you have to do two at-home tests online. And it's like, and I wouldn't have been able to do any of that stuff unless I had this app on my phone. Like, it was just like, what would happen if I didn't have an iPhone? Like, what, like I'd just be thrown into jail. It's just, anyway, yeah, once these technologies happen, it's really hard to sort of reverse them. So it's definitely a cause for concern, I think.
And we know that just the data that they're collecting and they're just watching our every move is just sometimes quite frightening.
It's
I mean, I
really
feel like I go to the
frightening,
store, I went to the store and I bought like a couple of chairs a few weeks ago. And I thought, I'm just in a furniture store. Nobody knows I'm here. And the next thing I know, I'm getting like leather chair, ads on my news feed. I'm like, dang, they knew I went to a department store and bought some chairs.
yeah. Yeah, I've had some real creepy things happen, including like seeing somebody in this bathing suit on the beach and then an ad for the bathing suit showing up on my phone. I'm not joking. I was like, did I talk about that bathing suit with the person I was with? Or like, anyway, so but back to transmission. So the film focuses particularly on the transitioning of kids. So what's the history of this idea, this term trans kids? When did this concept start to be normalized? When did we start to talk about that as a thing, a trans kid?
You know what? I wish I knew the etymology of the word and exactly like who coined it. I mean, I can tell you who coined the term transhumanist, but I can't think of like who gets credit for putting that into our lexicon as a word, as an idea. I mean, one of the experts in the film talks about how gender, 20 some 30 years ago wasn't even really part of our language. I mean, we used it sort of artistically, linguistically, but not in any kind of diagnostic or political fashion like we throw it around now. I mean, we've always had, children that were born with, some of these spectrum issues, kids that were born with an extra X or an extra Y or the ambiguous genitalia at birth. We weren't quite sure what was going on genetically until all the genetic tests came back. So the actual occurrence in human nature, but when it became this word that we started describing this child as trans, I'm gonna have to find out because that's something that's really interesting to me.
Do you know, I mean, can you talk more a bit about that, the popularization and normalization of the term gender? When did that start happening?
Was it around some of the big data points, milestones in sort of the feminist movement? Was it something that came out of more tolerance and liberation of gay, same-sex attracted people? But it was certainly, in my experience in medicine, it certainly wasn't a phrase that we used in medicine. So it might have been more of a political or a sociological term that evolved. And certainly, definitely wasn't a phrase or word we used with children.
Right.
We certainly saw, children, little boys that were effeminate, more feminine, little girls that were, but we didn't use the word gender.
Yeah, or like, yeah, it seems to me that the term gender identity is very new. I think I wasn't really aware of that term. It seems like it's popped up in the last decade, right?
Yeah, it's maybe 20 years tops, but yeah, it's a relatively new, and it again gets to sort of the technological speed, how fast things come at us these days. When you look at this whole transing of kids movement, and it's like lightning speed, this whole change of language. I mean, even the pride flag is new and changed this year. So it's a moving target. And but it is situated nicely in this sort of transhumanist philosophy of we can change who we are, medically, surgically, technologically. We can become whatever we in our heads think we are or want to be. And it's odd because on one hand we are using all this medicine, science, technology to trans people, children or adults. And then on the other hand, we're offering them medical and technological interventions later on down the road, like in the case of fertility preservation. We can turn you into a trans identified man, but later on down the road, if you want children, we can technologically help you now have your own children. This is kind of schizophrenic.
And you're right. I mean, this idea of trans kids and the transitioning of kids took hold so quickly and so recently. It all just happened so fast, and now it's this thing that is, a widespread trend, but it's also a thing that you can't talk critically about. Like, you're not even allowed to question it. It's so nuts. I mean, why do you think the idea of trans kids came to be? What's the purpose of this? Why is there this insistence that there is such a thing as a trans kid, and if a kid identifies or is identified as trans, it's really, really important that they be put on a path towards transition, and it's totally dangerous if you don't.
Yeah. Well, I think again, a lot of this we tease out in the film with the various people that we interview on camera. And there's one physician who I thought spoke really eloquently about this. And he's a pediatric endocrinologist, so he's been taking care of all kinds of kids, for his whole entire career. And he sort of lays it at the feet, if you will, of older transsexuals, that couldn't block their puberty. So they went through puberty. I'm thinking of, the scenario I'm thinking is the biological male. This person went through puberty and then as an adult were not happy. So they, took estrogen, dressed in women's clothing, wore makeup, whatever. But they aren't happy because they look like men. They've got deep voices, they've got Adam's apples, they've got, hairy bodies and big hands and big feet. And he points out that it was sort of those men who were unhappy with the fact that they in their minds think they're women, they want to look like women and they don't. So he says, they said, aha, if we can stop puberty, stop that from ever happening, then this little boy, when he grows up, will be feminine in his appearance and he won't have to worry about big hands, big feet, big jaws, deep voice. But I also think it's a money-driven ideology. This is, there's, we love technology, right? What's, I live in the backyard of the Silicon Valley. We say we have a front seat on the future. Everybody wants to, what's the next gimmick? What's the next thing? Same thing in medicine. People are looking for cures. People are looking for treatments. They, something they can patent. And this is a whole area of medicine. When you hear Hachi in the film, who's a detransitioned man, he went to a physician at Stanford. He felt like he's just trying to get in on the game. This was his first trans surgery. He's like, oh, I'm going to stake my claim here. I'm going to, become an expert at Stanford in this kind of, this surgical intervention. So I think that's a lot of it. When I look at big corporation, this is slacktivism. It's so easy for big corporations who have buckets of money to just put a rainbow flag on their logo for the month of June, and put their employees through diversity training and tolerance and, that kind of stuff. And it makes it doesn't cost big corporations a lot of money, but it puts them in, in the cocktail party circuit, of the popular companies that are welcoming.
Yeah, I mean that's the part that I really find, I find it shocking that people who consider themselves to be leftist or progressives are going along with supporting, advocating for these practices that, are really driven and supported by massive corporations. I mean, I just don't know when progressive people started believing that big pharma always had their best interests in mind.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why we particularly wanted to make a film speaking to parents, speaking to parents that have kids in this space, this is this phenomenon that's whether you take the language of social contagion and you look at how many young girls are getting caught up in this and the internet and TikTok and Snapchat and Reddit and all these influences in their mind, it is affecting progressive and liberal families, as well as conservative, right and left. This is not a, it's like cancer. It's not a disease that, it only affects people on the political right or the political left. It affects everybody. So what I've seen in the making of this movie in particular is how many people who are struggling with this with their own children and their own communities or their own kids' schools on the left are so afraid to speak out. So I know quite a few families that are thrilled that I made this film, but when I talk to them about, well, let's organize a screening because they're all, in their little their communities and their networks are pretty networked. They're like, we can't out ourselves because well, maybe I'll lose my job. Look what happened to you. Just a blink of an eye. And so there's so many parents that are struggling with this with their children. Or children in their family, perhaps not even their own children, but they're afraid to speak out because of what it does to your livelihood.
It seems like there's a couple of problems, at least in terms of the participation of parents in all of this. One of that is that I think, like you say, I mean, a lot of parents are just scared to speak up. In Canada, parents have been punished for not going along with their kids' transition. Like Rob Hoogland, you probably heard about him, who's in jail now because he wouldn't stop speaking about this and because, he wouldn't go along with his daughter's transition. They don't even, it seems like they don't even have a say anymore. And, the courts are going along with, gotta use correct pronouns. So, it's, they're entering into this totally biased system that's
Exactly. And
against
in the
them.
film, like there's three of the moms that we interviewed six parents, and three of the moms, we had to use fake names and blur their faces because they wanted to speak. They really wanted to be part of the project, but they needed to, for various reasons, like we're discussing, needed to be anonymous. And then in just post-production, We had to go back to everybody on the crew that we worked with, whether they were lighting, sound, audio mixers, whatever, because you always give credit, you list them in the credits, and we had to be sure that they knew that this was going to be a controversial film because, people in that kind of movie industry, you can literally never work again, just to make sure that they were cool if they, were mentioned and thanked in the credits. So it's really unfortunate because, like you say, it's become so toxic that you can't even civilly engage and speak your mind.
Yeah, and so there's that part of the problem, and then there's the other side of the problem, which is that there's a lot of parents who are, it seems like it's the parents who are driving their kids towards transition. They'll say, "Oh, well, my little boy likes playing with dolls and wearing dresses. Maybe he's a girl." And they sort of plant that idea in their kid's head, and not in a sinister way necessarily. They probably, I assume that most parents, for the most part, have the happiness and well-being of their child in mind. I think they're maybe trying to help, but it seems strange that a parent would think it would be a good idea to tell their kid that maybe they're the opposite sex, and maybe I need to stop my child from going through puberty so that he or she can become the person that they truly are.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things going on there, and it's not a one size fits all that, these are all the parents and this is where they're coming at. I mean, some of them are just scared, and then they go to some, doctor, pediatrician, that says the classic line, if you don't allow your child to do this, they're going to harm themselves. They're going to commit suicide. So there's that cudgel that parents are told. The two detransitioners that we interviewed in the film, these people came from backgrounds of huge trauma, whether it be parental trauma or sexual abuse or sexual violence, or, they're just so there's that, and then the whole issue of are these just children that naturally would be maybe grow up to be gay or lesbian, and the parents or whatever can't deal with that. Maybe even the older young child can't deal with that, so it's easier for them to become trans. And the issue of autism, one of the fathers that we interviewed in the film, his son's been diagnosed with autism. So he's, a kid already that has, some issues going on that makes him think that he's really a girl and he doesn't want to grow up and go through puberty. So there's so many things at play here. And this gets me back to, my background in pediatric nursing, because medical doctors, when they see these kids, should be saying things like, let's really do a good evaluation of what's going on in this kid's life. What's their internet use like? Are they being bullied at school? Is the home an absolute wreck? Is there some other kind of psychological things going on here? So there's, Cruz, who was one of the pediatric endocrinologists in the film, likes to say, just because we don't do trans, we don't allow children to block their puberty and go on to cross-sex hormones, doesn't mean we do nothing for these kids. And what we do is going to be dependent on what that individual child needs. That's good old-fashioned evidence-based medicine here. What is going on with this child and what is the proper good way to treat them? And I would say that we never block puberty in children, and we never allow them to take cross-sex, wrong-sex hormones as children. That's just a, for me, that's just a bright line. We don't, it's human experimentation on these children.
Well, and puberty is an absolutely necessary part of developing a healthy adult body. Like, to me, it's weird that unless there was some kind of dangerous medical condition that needed that kind of intervention, I know that they prescribe, so-called puberty blockers to kids who have precocious puberty. I don't really know much more about that process and how that works, but like I'm open to the idea that there are some circumstances where that might be necessary, but in this case, it's not necessary. There's no medical emergency. These children don't have any kind of health risks if they aren't put on puberty blockers, and puberty blockers and the consequent hormones that they end up on at a certain point, you know, that is harmful to their health in really big ways. And there's still people, a lot of people, like liberal people, who are questioning the concept of gender identity, or questioning, you know, this idea that, you know, we shouldn't be more careful about transitioning kids, questioning the idea of whether or not you can change sex, but will still say, you know, like, well, but, you know, some kids, I think they really do need to go on puberty blockers. Like, I think in some, you know, if they genuinely are suffering from gender dysphoria, this is going to improve their lives. So we should do that. But just not in, we need to be more careful, because there's a lot of people who, you know, change their minds later. And to me, that's not good enough. That doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. And, you know, you're right. There are very, very rare, not common cases where a child will need to be on these kinds of medications. But in the case of just gender dysphoria, it's not, you're right. I mean, puberty is a natural, normal part of human development, just like menopause is. You know, we've seen enough in the research on menopause and all the women that took, you know, estrogen replacement therapy and what we learned after. I was like, oh my gosh, that's not really a good thing. So we, you know, try not to put women on long-term estrogen therapy as they're going through menopause, and just recognize this is a normal process, that, you know, what can we do to sort of help the symptoms, so you're not, you know, hot flashing and, you know, insomnia can be off the wall. But the same thing with puberty. So much is going on in puberty, not just in the sexual reproductive organs of, you know, making you an infertile child to a fertile person. But, you know, your brain development, your bone development, it's all an orchestrated, I mean, the human body is this sort of amazing, you know, organism, and it's so connected, that to think you can stop a critical part of normal human development, you know, whether that be for months or years, or, you know, how we know that puberty is not a fixed point in time for all of us, without thinking that that could be harmful is pretty naive, I guess, as far as just one human reproduction 101, human anatomy physiology 101. And they, again, knowing that there's so many other things that we can be offering these children that perhaps have true gender dysphoria or body dysmorphia, or you know, all the things that are going through kids' minds that make them just hate themselves or think they're in the wrong body.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I would hope that there would be other ways to treat this kind of, you know, disorder, or, you know, feelings, or what have you, depending on the scale of seriousness. You know, what other options do we have? You know, what are some better alternatives, in your opinion, to puberty blockers, hormones, social transition, all of that?
I think it gets back to what's the root cause, what's going on, which is why you just need a good workup. I mean, when you think about it, you go to the doctor and you've got these symptoms and they don't know what's wrong with you. You know, they just run a battery of tests, and they, you know, take x-rays, they draw blood. You know, they make you touch your nose with your fingers and, you know, touch your toes and walk across a straight line, you know, all to kind of diagnose what's going on. And then in the case of children, the diagnostic also needs to look at what's going on in the home, what's going on in the school, you know, so we can see what the symptom, we know what the symptom is this gender dysphoria, but what's the cause of these symptoms? So I think the first step is to just get, this is where it gets me back to, you know, where are the good doctors, the good proper medical physicians that will do that kind of work. And then maybe the child needs to be referred to some kind of counseling, some kind of therapy. Maybe the family needs some kind of therapy. Maybe some intervention needs to be done in the school if there's something going on at the school. Maybe a diagnosis of some kind of spectrum, autism or something, you know, Asperger's is made. And then based on whatever that good diagnostic workup shows, then you would base the treatment plan around that. But, you know, blocking puberty and turning somebody and making somebody think they can change their sex is not going to treat all those things. And we've seen that in the studies of adults. I mean, you know, the big study out of Sweden that, you know, that looked at transgender people who fully medically and surgically transitioned, and it didn't solve all those dysphoric feelings. We're seeing that with the detransitioners. How many times have you heard a detransitioner say, oh, I detransitioned because it didn't fix anything? And now I've got no breasts and I've got no uterus and I've got these long-term medical complications because I took the wrong sex hormones for so many years.
Right. I mean, and one of the things that we're told as a means to, you know, pressure people to accept transition, I mean, parents in particular, but also, you know, people who challenge the transitioning of kids, we're told that if we don't support this, if we don't do it, if we don't get these kids started onto transition, their suicide rates really go up. So, you know, so it's really dangerous. And if you don't support it, you're putting these kids' lives in danger. Is there any validity to that? Is it true?
No, there's, you know, and when you think about, again, this is a new phenomenon. And I, you know, we talked earlier, I can't pinpoint when this whole trans kid idea came along, but it's a relatively new phenomenon. But that doesn't mean that kids weren't, you know, a little bit confused, you know, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, and we didn't see all these kids that were just killing themselves. And we have to be really serious about suicide risk and suicide ideation. But how we usually treat those kinds of things is through good psychiatric counseling care and maybe some, you know, kind of pharmaceuticals, you know, to deal with bipolar or depression or, you know, mood kind of issues. But that has always been the treatment for people that are suicidal. It's not just to, you know, make them believe that they can become something that their body will never be. You know, even if you think you're a woman, you will never be a woman. You can take all the pills and have all the surgeries and cosmetic and otherwise, and you will never be able to transition to the other sex.
How easy is it for kids to transition in the U.S.? What's the process there now?
Well, that's one of the scandals, isn't it? Is that it is pretty darn easy. I mean, one of the moms in the film, you know, talked about how her daughter just walked into a Planned Parenthood clinic and walked out with a, you know, a prescription for testosterone. And, you know, the last I checked, the Planned Parenthood clinic physician probably had never probably seen this girl before. It wasn't where she went for her primary care, you know, a doctor who knew her medical history and trusted her. And I think Alex Aaron has done, you know, the woman who runs the Gender Mapper project has done a really good job of just tracking the number of clinics in the United States and Canada, you know, in the hundreds, and how fast they popped up. Again, this points back to sort of the lucrativeness of this new emerging field of medicine, again, in quotes. So I think if you have, you know, parents who take you off to the pediatrician and the pediatrician who is very much in support of this, it should not be very difficult at all. We know that schools are already very supportive of this, and we've got the families that are debating, you know, this whole boys and girls sports, and young girls in Connecticut who are mad that, you know, they didn't get to compete because they were, you know, kind of lost their you know, their chance at competition because there were, you know, men competing in their sports. So, and, you know, we certainly have had, you know, families blasting school boards for, you know, introducing this kind of teaching into the curriculum and letting little boys and little girls swap bathrooms and stuff. So it's sad that it is, unfortunately, relatively easy. Now, what I don't know, and I haven't been able to figure out, is this something that's just only available to privileged people that have access to healthcare? You know, we're not like Canada. We don't have a social system for healthcare here. If you're a low-income, poor child whose family doesn't have insurance, and you're, you know, if you have gender dysphoria, are you going to have one of these posh gender clinics taking you on and offering you free? I don't know. That's something I'm going to try to dig around and find an answer to that, because I kind of want to say in the United States, it seems to be a phenomenon that's more happening in, you know, upper middle class homes.
Tell me about, like, are there medical professionals who are pushing back against this? I mean, again, you know, I mean, I know why people don't push back, because I know that there's a very real risk of losing your job. I mean, in Canada, we're dealing with a bill right now that, you know, essentially criminalizes therapists who try to offer other alternatives to kids beyond transition or who question transition. In the U.S., what's happening with pushback? Who's behind the pushback?
Yeah, there absolutely are physicians and therapists. I think of Sasha Ayed who's a therapist. But yeah, there are physicians. I mean, three of them are in our film. Two of them are pediatric endocrinologists. One's a family practice doctor. You know, there's a group SEGM, and I forget what SEGM stands for, SEGM, which is, you know, academic researcher scientist organized to push back and really get good scientific data out there on this issue of transitioning. Now, we sadly in the U.S., we don't have the big professional organizations. You know, the Pediatric Endocrine Society has, you know, totally jumped onto the trans train, which is unfortunate. The American Academy of Pediatricians, for example, also has been very pro-transing of kids, which is really unfortunate because those are, you know, they're professional societies. And they speak volumes because they can issue their policy statements and their, you know, and the media loves to cite that. Well, the American Academy of Pediatrics says, you know, this is wonderful and it's great. But I am encouraged that there are quite a few, and probably more than I know, and probably a lot of physicians just privately in their own office are just saying, no, let's get, you know, Johnny or Susie to a counselor, or let's do what I was suggesting earlier, you know, get a good workup and see what's going on with this kid in all areas of their life to see what they can do to help this family and this child. I mean, families are in this together when you're dealing with minor children. But I, you know, Megan, I have to always be optimistic. I'm forever the optimist, or else I wouldn't be able to get up and do this work every day.
Yeah, I know. Tell me about it. I mean, we can't be too cynical. Otherwise, there's really no point in us doing what we're doing, I suppose, as well, except for the whole telling the truth thing and fighting back against something that's wrong that's happening so we can live with ourselves.
We released the film like 5 days ago, and I thought within the first 24 hours, YouTube would have pulled it. And it's still going strong. I think last I checked, we have, you know, over 23,000 people have watched this film in 5 days, and the comments are overwhelmingly positive. Yes, there's the stinker, the hater, you know, you're a bunch of transphobes, you know, the thumbs up are, you know, way outpacing the negative. So I am encouraged that the film is so far being very well received, and we haven't been canceled or yanked down for violation of community standards or something.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wonder if that's connected to the fact that more and more people are speaking out, and maybe these social media companies are getting wise to the fact that this isn't really flying with people anymore. I don't know if that's true or not, but possibly, hopefully.
And I am mindful of the fact that my film was launched after, you know, years of work that people like you have been doing in this space. And so it wasn't like, you know, I just sort of rolled onto the scene and put this film out, but I, you know, I added it to the collection of all of our collective work that has been saying things like, you know, we never thought we'd ever have to say, like, I'm sorry, a man can never be a woman.
Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. I wonder, you know, was there anything in the making of this film that particularly shocked or upset you? I mean, beyond the entire situation.
Well, it was shocked and upset, you know, to hear, because we did an interview two members of the medical profession that support this. So that is always just upsetting to me, just to have to sit there and listen as the cameras are rolling without, you know, screaming, what happened to you in medical school? So that was probably maybe more on the unsettling side. You know, it was just undone with, you know, how, you could just see this with the parents, this, the sadness, the feeling like nobody's in their corner. You know, their schools are against them, the pediatricians against them, even their family, you know, family members in many cases are against them. You know, the stress that it's put on their whole entire family. You know, you have a child that's struggling in this space, you can imagine the stress it puts on other children in the home, the marriages, the relationships. So just that feeling that, gosh, these people just feel like they've got nobody that's, you know, on their team, which is sad for me. And the detransitioner stories are just very sad, just to hear the trauma that led these people to do such extreme things to their body in hopes that this would help them, and know that it didn't.
Yeah, the detransitioner stories are always so heartbreaking and maddening. Just it's just unforgivable what's happening to these kids. What kinds of things did you hear from the detransitioners? What kinds of things are they saying led them to transition?
Well, sexual abuse as children, rape, in and out of foster care, living in a home with a revolving door of violent men that came and went, having to steal for food because there was no money to buy food. I'm not from a wealthy background by any means, but I never experienced that kind of trauma and poverty and unsettledness. I mean, knowing what I know from the years that I worked with children in the hospital, we certainly saw kids that were in the hospital because of, domestic violence in the home or child abuse or neglect or whatever. But, that just really takes a toll on kids. I mean, kids just want to go to bed at night and know that they're safe, and they don't have to worry that the people that are, in charge or over them or caring for them are going to hurt them. So that just breaks my heart.
Yeah. And of course, I mean, I should have mentioned that, most of the kids who are transitioning now are girls, right? And most of the kids who are teens or youth or whatever who are detransitioning are also young women. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think as a medical and psychiatric counseling profession, we should be looking into why is that? What else? It's not all of a sudden girls are thinking they're born in the wrong body and they were meant to be men. What's really going on with these young women, that's making them feel and think this way?
Yeah, for sure. So you say the film's been pretty well received. I mean, have you experienced any kind of pushback or difficulties around getting it out there, or just in terms of response?
No, I mean, I guess, we knew this would be the case, or I knew this would be the case. I mean, the mainstream media is pretty much ignoring the film. We've gotten quite a bit of press, but it's come predominantly from the more conservative side of the aisle as far as journalists that are willing to write these kinds of stories and talk about this kind of a film. But no, we didn't really have any difficult. I mean, the most difficult thing, like I said earlier on in our conversation, was just producing a film during a global pandemic. I would have loved to have interviewed you in person for the film, but just with the, I'm in the United States and you weren't, I couldn't travel and get to you. But no, it's been pretty well received, and so far, I'm just kind of hoping that YouTube plays nice and they just let us do our thing.
Yeah. So the film's available on YouTube, obviously. So it's really easily accessible.
It's
I'll of
free. It's
course
free to
link to
watch.
it. It's free. I'll link to it in our podcast notes and put it up on the site alongside the podcast so people can watch it. Thanks so much for talking with me about this today. And again, thank you so much for your work. I can't wait to see you again in real life.
Yeah, me too. Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
Okay. Thank you so much. Have a great night.
You too. Bye.
Okay, bye. You just heard an interview with Jennifer Lahl, founder and president of the Center for Bioethics and Culture Network and director of Transmission. To learn more about her work, visit cbc-network.org. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. You can find us online at feministcurrent.com, tweet at us at feministcurrent, or send us an email at info@feministcurrent.com. We are hosted by Libsyn, and you can subscribe to the Feminist Current podcast anywhere you like to listen. iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, TuneIn, Spotify, and beyond. You can even give us 5 stars and a review on iTunes. Feminist Current is produced and hosted by myself, Megan Murphy, out of Vancouver, BC. If you enjoyed this podcast, consider making a donation to support our work. Just visit feministcurrent.com and click the donate button.